Everybody, welcome back to another edition of Mind Shift Podcast. Once again, I am Dr. Clint Haycock, welcoming you to another show. I'm your fellow traveler along this road of deconstruction and discovery. This week, I'm bringing you a great conversation that I had recently with a friend of mine. His name is Tim Malins, and we go way back. I've been talking about this in the last couple of weeks, about how he came up from Southern California and went to this little Christian school that me and a bunch of my friends were part of just outside of Seattle, Washington. He came up when he was about 12 or 13 years old, and he was dropped right into the middle of this Christian fundamentalist culture. And in this episode today, Tim's going to describe the effects of Christian fundamentalism on his mind, because the interesting part, of course, is that he didn't have any background in church, spirituality, religion. His parents were from England. They certainly wouldn't call themselves born-again Christians. And this is what is so fascinating about hearing Tim's story. Here's a guy who didn't have any context of church or Christianity or the Bible, suddenly dropped into this pretty bizarre environment. And how did it affect his mind? How did it affect his life? And he goes on to talk about how he became an atheist. So we're going to be getting into that in just a few minutes. It's a fascinating story. But before we get into Tim's experiences, I'll just mention really quickly that there's a couple of ways you can get a hold of me in terms of social media. You can follow me on Twitter at MindShift2018. And there's some other links to social media, which I've put in the show notes. You can also become a supporter of MindShift Podcast by going to patreon.com/MindShiftPodcast and find out some more information about how you can support the show for as little as $1 a month. Also, if you're a follower on Podbean, you can support the show through the crowdfunding app. Just click the button on the MindShift Podbean page. If you do decide to support the show, you'll be added into our closed private MindShift Podcast Facebook group. And you'll also get a shout out on this show if you join our group. Also, you can support this show by going to TeePublic and buying a MindShift Podcast t-shirt for just $20. And all these things help me to cover the expenses of this show and keep bringing you great content each and every Friday. So thank you for your support. And just one last favor, if you've been helped by this show at all, please consider leaving a review on iTunes or Podbean, which will help with the visibility of this show. So that would be great if you could do that for me too. Now back on this subject of my conversation with Tim Malins, one of the most significant things that happened to him that he talks about in this show is how he came across a book by Carl Sagan. It's called The Demon-Haunted World, Science as a Candle in the Dark. And when Tim mentioned it in this show, I'd never heard of the book. Although I knew who Carl Sagan was, I'd never read any of his work. So I went out and found myself a copy, and I've been working my way through it ever since I talked to Tim. And it's true. It's a very challenging, thought-provoking book. And I'm going to be reading a quote or two from it after my conversation with Tim. And I would encourage you to grab yourself a copy of this book as well. Take a look at it. It is an eye-opening book that will certainly make you think. Well, there's no time like the present, so without further ado, I'm going to bring you right now the chat with Tim Malins and myself. Let's go surfing with the atheist. I'm happy to be joined here today by a good old friend of mine, man. We go way, way back. This is Tim Malins. We're talking to you. You're from Tybee Island, Georgia. Is that right?
That's right.
How warm is it there right now? You must have nice, sunny, warm weather.
It's in the 70s. We actually did get some snow this year. It's insane for deep south.
The deep south, yeah. I'm sitting in the middle of the beast from the east, the storm, the Siberian storm that's blown in. All across the UK, all across the continent, man, we've got 4 feet of snow. We're literally stuck. We can't get out. We tried to shovel our way out of the driveway today, and we just couldn't. We gave it up as a bad job. We couldn't get out. So you've got nice sunny weather, and I'm sitting in 4 feet of snow up here in North Wales. But it's really great to connect. We talked, what was it, about 2 weeks ago, I think it was, a week and a half ago?
Yeah, a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, whatever. Yeah, I kind of reconnected.
We actually go way, way, way back, man. I mean,
Well, I was at a really small Christian school out of Seattle, Washington. And you must have come in, you came up from Southern California, wasn't that right? Sometime, you was around sixth grade, something like that, seventh grade?
Yeah, my father's aircraft engineer, and he transferred from Northrop to Boeing, which a lot of Californians did. There was a big migration of Californians
yes,
up to the Pacific Northwest in those times, and
You guys blew up the housing market up there. Now, this is funny because I remember really clearly when you came to this Christian school, there was literally, we're talking a classroom size, seventh grade, there may have been 10 or 12 students.
I want to say
really
it was,
small. Well, it was just a really small school. We only had a couple hundred students probably from kindergarten all the way through eighth grade, I think is when we finished. So you were there for a couple years.
That.
And I remember you coming in because when you came to school, we were all wearing, you know, Sears jeans that we bought from a catalog. And you came in, you were wearing Levi's Buttonfly 501 jeans. You had Vans shoes. You were a skateboarder from Southern California. You were a surfer.
Yeah.
You rocked our world, man.
A fish out of water.
Yeah, sure. But you were like the coolest kid that we'd ever known. Because you wore Ocean Pacific shirts and all that. within 5 minutes, every one of us had Buttonfly 501 jeans. We had to get, you know, the Vans shoes and the whole thing. So yeah, you were bringing in the Southern cool California fashion.
Yeah, I don't think
up to the Northwest.
I don't remember being the cool kid necessarily, but
you were a fashion setter, man, trendsetter.
I remember being a fish out of water, basically. And that's how we kind of ended up in that school because when I was, you know, in junior high school in California, my whole culture was skateboarding and surfing. Yeah, that's everything I knew. I played soccer, too. That's another thing. My father was a soccer coach.
That's right. We played on the same soccer team together for a long time.
Yeah, you played on our team. Yeah,
we played soccer together. Yep, all the way through high school as well.
The listeners out there, Clint's really humble, but he was a very good soccer player.
That's a long story, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to make that my career.
And then I went on to high school.
It didn't work out. So yeah, you come up to this little tiny school in Washington State. There's like a couple hundred students all the way through. But the thing is you weren't raised in any kind of Christian context at all, were you? I mean, what's the backstory there? How did you end up at this little tiny Christian school out of Seattle?
I think my parents knew that I was sort of a fish out of water. I mean, cause my whole culture was like a beach culture. I literally grew up walking distance to the beach, friends going to the skate park. I grew up right down the street from Warren Miller, the famous action sports ski filmmaker, and I was friends with his stepson, and we grew up skateboarding together. I think my transition when I moved to Seattle, I was about 12 years old. So it was kind of, that was my culture. I think when I came to Seattle, it's kind of like, I think my parents probably thought he's different from all these kids, and I didn't really relate. I met some kids in the neighborhood, didn't relate to them. So I think kind of their thinking, what I was comfortable with, I just felt like I've been dropped in another planet. You know, going to Maple Valley from Palos Verdes, California, and I think my parents thought, and I was more comfortable going to go to a small school.
Not necessarily because it was a Christian school, but just because it was a small school.
Yeah, because it was a small school. And I think the Christian school was kind of part of it. You know, they're probably nice kids there, you know, I think on some level, but I ended
Let's
up there.
So.
Yeah. And I felt like I dropped in that school and I assimilated pretty quickly. I liked meeting you and some of our other friends. So I liked it.
But you weren't prepared for the sort of fundamentalist Christian side of it. I mean,
no.
Talk us through that kind of scenario because you're coming out of basically a secular background, right? Your parents weren't really religious.
Oh, completely.
Your folks, they're actually from Britain, weren't they?
Not religious whatsoever. My mother's probably one of those people that's kind of like, yeah, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual, but whatever. I should probably all say my entire family's from England. And in Europe, it's just not that fundamentalist thing. It just really isn't a thing.
It's definitely an American, or it can be a more American thing.
It's American, sort of born again Christianity is just completely off their radar. They didn't know what it was. But yeah, I was kind of dropped into that. It was new to me to have Bible study, and I sort of treated it. I thought, okay, we have Bible study, but in my mind, I was kind of like, okay, this is kind of like studying Tolkien or Lord of the Rings, but not as good. It was interesting, but it wasn't like I took it that seriously that age. But it, some of these beliefs sort of wormed in there.
Because you come into this context, you're like a fish out of water. You say dropped into this scenario. It's a Christian school. It's kind of a fundamentalist Christian school, but it starts to affect you though, these teachings. How did they affect you? Because this is really interesting, because the difference between you and me, other than the fact that I didn't grow up in Southern California skating and surfing and everything else, I grew up in Seattle and I was in the church from literally day one. I mean, when I was born, my mom took me to church when I was a baby. I was probably a week or two old, and I was in church every single Sunday my whole life. I went to Christian school. None of this fazed me because it was what I'd always heard growing up from literally day one.
Yeah.
So you've got the opposite scenario. You're dropped into this thing. How do these teachings, start to affect you?
I was dropped into the cold. Yeah.
Yeah. You were completely dropped in. Yeah. How did it affect you then?
So that experience was, at first it's just something you learn. You went along with it and it's just some sort of history or whatever. And then I got more into, because I met friends and friends I like, you and other people, and I ended up going to the church.
Ah, so now you go from school to the church.
And getting involved with youth groups and this and that. And then it started to kind of get in there. It started to, for lack of a better term, indoctrinate.
Right. So what were some of these teachings that got in there? What was some of this indoctrination that kind of seeped in over the years? We all went to school together. We all went to church together.
Yeah.
It was a whole big community. We all basically went to the same church, and then we all went to this same little Christian school, and then you come dropping in. So now this is starting to affect you. What were some of these teachings that kind of crept in?
I felt conflicted from kind of my home life, which they weren't necessarily religious at all, but I was learning all these things in school. I felt really conflicted. Some of those things were like, for example, I remember at the small Christian school we were in, I remember them teaching us some like creationism. And
they didn't go in for evolution, did they? Not at all.
Oh, no. They were not fans. Yeah.
Not fans
but
of Darwin.
Also, evolution wasn't even on the table. I didn't know what it was. But I remember them teaching creationism, and they touched on evolution as the wrong thing.
Yeah, it was the boogeyman.
These are these scientists, whatever, and they are wrong, and here's why. But I remember we had a test concerning creationism, and then I remember one of the questions on the test, which was probably made up by the teacher, was, is it possible that humans evolve from animals? According to the Genesis story, is this possible? And I remember writing that, yes, it's possible, because according to Genesis, animals were created first. So, it's possible. I remember just writing that. When I got my test back, I remember getting marked down and a whole line tell me how wrong I was.
It was against the Bible.
Yeah. It was, but I was, 13 or something like that?
Right.
That was like my first part, like free thinking. But I honestly, in my naive head at the time, I didn't think they'd get marked down for it. I thought they would say, plausible. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know. But that's when I first started getting kind of sucked in a bit with the ideology. And then the other thing is when, and I can't remember the exact point, but I remember it was, I want to say it was a little bit outside of school, but it was like other events, like retreat. They started touch on end times and Armageddon and that sort of thing.
Ah, yes. The old Bible and prophecy, end times event.
Scare attack, sort of. Like this, if you don't sign on to this thing, this could happen to you. And it was also like, we're not trying to scare you now. Don't think we're trying to scare you, but you need to watch this film. It's a hard thing on a kid, kind of portraying that the future is grim. For me, it was hard, maybe, as opposed to you. You know, you had tough things to go through. My challenge was coming from a secular background and having parents that weren't necessarily born-again Christians at all. I started feeling conflicted, going, oh, God, I'm sort of worried about my family.
Because they're not Christians.
You know, because they're not Christians. So it's like, okay, well, what if I sign on to this? I feel like I'm going to get saved. God, I really love my dad, my mother, my sister. You know, I just felt like there's a lot of pressure for a kid. If I was going to sign on to this whole thing, like, well, I can't. It's going to happen to my family if I'm saved, if I'm raptured. And they're not.
They're going to get left behind. That's what happens.
I don't feel good about that. And how good am I going to feel being raptured? The people I love are left behind. That was my experience being dropped in this fundamentalist Christian culture where my family wasn't necessarily part of it. I worried for my family level. I was conflicted about that as a young person. I'm sure he probably didn't notice that when we were hanging out. It's not like it's something I talked about or anything like that, but it was something internally that concerned me.
We all were. I don't think we necessarily noticed it, because it was like the frog in the boiling water. We're just in this system.
Yeah.
But I can remember being absolutely petrified. I watched that movie. They made us watch A Thief in the Night. And that's one of the movies that you're referring to. And talks about these people that don't believe in God. And they get left behind after the rapture. And they have to go through all this tribulation and torture. And I mean, I was petrified.
They were terrifying.
I was terrified. Like
you signed on, or if you didn't, this horrible thing would happen to you.
Yeah, scare tactics, basically.
If you still want to get in heaven.
What about some of the moral things you talked about the other day, about feeling conflicted about, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing the wrong thing? The church was the one, or the school and the church, they were the ones that introduced this idea of sort of a moral code, and that there's immoral and moral behaviors. Did you feel like there was a sense of being conflicted over some of these behavioral issues too?
For me, it was more about art and music. When we went to a Christian high school in Seattle, there was a contract.
I don't remember that.
That said you wouldn't use alcohol or recreational, like smoke pot or whatever. That wasn't so much a problem with me. I'm not going to say it didn't happen later on in high school. But I think what was conflicting with me was art, music, and also science. There are certain music I like, and there's a lot of things about, you know, different art and things I really like, but I knew that was, and that's why I'm kind of leading on to, that was secular.
Oh, yes.
And the word secular, I didn't really know before that. And I felt like the school put on, or the environment, use the word secular as a dividing.
Right, so this black and white kind of thinking, binary thinking.
Exactly, yes, exactly. There was a lot of music I liked. There's a lot of really cool stuff. There's amazing stuff in the 80s.
Yes, there was.
Really cool stuff. But this school didn't approve of it. And I don't know, it was sort of ingrained, like, no, you're not putting that picture of that band up in your locker. I know it's petty, but it made you feel very conflicted.
I remember it's a couple of funny stories, because you said, okay, your parents were British.
And because you had that connection to Britain, I remember you turning us on to some British punk bands that nobody in our area had ever heard of before.
Yeah.
Because you had these connections with Great Britain. The other thing was, I remember going over to your house one time. We were probably in eighth grade or so, staying the night, and you put on The Who, and you played the song Who Are You? And I'd never heard The Who before. And you said, now you got to listen really carefully, because he actually uses the F word in this song. And this was like, ooh, this is really bad secular music.
Yeah. Funny. I don't specifically remember that. I remember you coming over.
But it was a sneaky thing. And it was like,
but I remember time buying The Clash, London Calling, which is one of the greatest albums of all time. Double Record. There was a warning sticker on profanity of it.
Oh, yes.
And, you know, and I remember feeling conflicted about it, going, I really like it. God, it's really good. I feel really bad. You know, on some level. And I never really voiced it. I was not the guy that stood up at chapel and did, I never did communion. I never stood up at chapel and did a testimonial. I kind of thought the people that did were kind of attention seek or whatever, but I didn't want any attention. But it wasn't like I was fully signed on to the ideology, but I always had something in the back of my mind that said, what if there's some truth to what they're saying? I mean, obviously I'm going to the school because there's some teachers that are smarter than me, and they're teaching me math and biology and physiology and English and how to write well. And I'm not taking anything away from the school for that. I learned to write very well. I learned biology and physiology very well. Of course, they skipped over evolution. So I missed out on that.
You missed out on evolution. They didn't have a class on Darwinian evolution, or if they did, it was debunk it. But you're
well,
right.
I think I remember them touching on it, but then they quickly debunked it. Let's move on.
That divide, the sacred and secular divide, is a big thing, isn't it? Because I can remember sitting in chapel services that we were, it was compulsory. We had to go every Thursday. And I remember they brought in people to give lectures on the evils of rock and roll music. Yeah, they showed us album covers of these heavy metal bands that were just, you know, Ozzy Osbourne and how he bitten the head off of a bat and played Stairway to Heaven backwards and the whole thing. And yet, like you say, I was getting into, I was getting into rock and roll and new wave music in the 80s. And it was just good music, man. I got into heavy metal and everything else. And I felt the same sort of conflicted. But after a while, I just said, you know what? Screw this. This music is too good. I don't care. I'm cranking it in my car. Oh, yeah. That's just the way it is.
That's exactly what happened to me. Yeah, yeah. But it was just that conflict. I really burned calories in my brain thinking about that.
Yeah, you waste a lot of energy.
It's a shame, But there was good things about the school. I think the education was good, even though we missed some science in there.
I think we missed a lot of science in there.
On the other side, though, we had Bible study.
Well, we had that Bible class.
Part of the curriculum.
Yeah, every year Bible you class. Had to take Bible 9, 10, 11, 12 year. You know, every year you had to take a Bible course.
Yeah.
That was part, like you said, and just part of the regular curriculum.
Came out of that, like, knowing the Bible very, very well.
But it was a particular hermeneutic. It was a way of reading the Bible from a very conservative or fundamentalist point of view, though, wasn't
it? Absolutely.
It wasn't just,
yes, it was taken
let's compare
very,
interpretations.
Very literal. Yeah, very literal. But, yeah, we learned the Bible is inspired word of God. I literally remember doing a Bible class with a teacher I liked a lot in other classes. But we were brought in, we Hal Lind's book was a textbook.
Right. The Late Great Planet Earth.
Yeah. We had to buy it. And it was basically about how the end of the world. And we had to study it. There were outlines on Dateline about there will be a limited nuclear war within 10 years. There will be a full-scale nuclear war with no time frame.
Yeah, so he lays the whole thing out.
It's hard to do to children because you're basically saying there's no future.
Unless you're a Christian.
You sign on to this thing. Like, and now I look back, of course, you go, Hal Lindsey was a nut job. Really, it's nonsensical. He's out the window right now. You know, and other people picked up that torch, the Left Behind guys, fooling Christians for profit. Yeah. But what a thing to do to children.
They would have seen it as preparing people. I think that's the motivation behind films like Left Behind and people like Hal Lindsey and other things is that they really believe that this is the end times scenario according to their interpretation of the Bible. And it's really, really, really important to get it right. Because if this is indeed the end of how the world is going to end, we need to be doing everything in our power to make sure that as many people are as Christians as possible before the end times hits. Otherwise, because then it's too late. That's the scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's too late that you're left behind. Literally, if you're not a Christian, you are left behind. You're done. There's no redeeming you now.
Yeah, but like the cynical part of me thinks, does he really believe that?
Oh, absolutely.
The Left Behind authors really believe that?
Yeah, because
they just want to sell books.
Yeah, I can remember when I was a member of a church in Seattle, we brought in Hal Lindsey for a week-long seminar.
Really?
Yes, at our church in Seattle, they brought him in. And he gave a week-long seminar every night of the week for like 4 or 5 nights on Bible prophecy, end times prophecy. And man, he had some great, slides and shows, all kinds of multimedia stuff back in the day, films and everything. And that was his whole scenario, how it was all going to end, what we needed to be doing now as Christians and like scaring us straight. You know, so he definitely believed in it, and that was his whole platform, was Bible prophecy, end times prophecy. I can remember one of my professors in seminary saying that the problem with a guy like Hal Lindsey is that he's interpreting the Bible with a newspaper in one hand and a Bible in the other. He's reading into it all these current events, and you can make anything fit. You know, he's got all these crazy interpretations, but that's how he was doing it, or one of the ways he was doing it. So, yeah, it scares you straight, as it were, if you buy into this whole theology of the end times, rapture, and everything else. So what happens to you then? You come out of this Christian school. You're somewhat conflicted. Where do you go from there? Because you didn't finish our Christian high school, did you? You went off to another school.
No, I didn't. I left reluctantly. Boeing was kind of in the dumps then, and my father was an aircraft engineer at Boeing. He did some other jobs, keep things going, but then he landed a job at Gulfstream, which is Savannah, Georgia. It was a good gig for my family, so we had to move that. I did an offer from family friends to stay in Seattle and do my last year, which I would have loved. I honestly would have loved because the connections there, the people, I'm still friends with people to this day. But yeah, I ended up just kind of getting dropped in a southern school, which was a Scottish Episcopal school. It was not evangelical at all. It was just a whole different thing. They even had a class called Comparative Religion, where I learned about Buddhism and Taoism, different religions, which was a great class.
It was the first time you ever really were exposed to other world religions, was it?
Yeah, and I learned that like Hinduism is one of the oldest religions in the world. I learned about Buddhism and their beliefs and Judaism. It went through a gamut of religious comparisons. It was pretty eye-opening. It was cool, but yeah, as far as like having beliefs, getting dropped into a different school, yeah, things are very, very different out of like a fundamental school.
So you've been up and down the gamut for sure. So you graduated from this little Christian school in Georgia. Where did you go from there? What did you do after that?
I did a little bit of college, but also I worked at a small thrift shop, and I ended up taking it over. Long story short, I ended up going back to the West Coast. I worked for a company, Palo Peralta, which they were like one of the prominent people in skateboarding. I was really lucky to get that job, and I worked for them for a while. I lived in Santa Barbara a while, which I loved. They took kind of a dive. There was kind of a shakeup in the market. They took a dive. I survived a round of layoffs. I was also the newest employee. I left there. I actually, luckily, got picked up by Tony Hawk.
Oh, yes, Tony Hawk.
Skateboarding. It was kind of a funny story. When I got laid off, I had my little box of your stereotypical thing when you get laid off. You have your little cardboard box with your little personal effects in it. And I walked out of the company. I was, like, waiting for my girlfriend to pick me up at the time or whatever. And I see this car roll up, and it's a black Honda Civic hatchback. And I go, oh, it looks familiar. And it had different skateboarding stickers on it. And I was like, oh, no. Oh, that can't be. You know, boom, hops out Tony Hawk, the poster boy of the company. He walks in and he goes, what's the deal with the box? And I go, I got nothing. I don't have a joke here or anything. I just got canned. And he just looked at me and he went, well, I got job security. And I was like, oh my God, that stung a bit.
Dude, you landed on your feet, man.
I had my tail between my legs. My girlfriend's coming to pick up. The funny story about Tony, though, is that he knew he was going to hire me. He was starting his own company, and he knew my name was on, my hat was in the ring of guys to hire. But he was going to let me off that easy. Yeah.
He had to screw with you a little bit.
He wasn't going to say, don't worry, man. Like, and then, you know, a week or so later, I found out, oh, yeah, I got the gig. And I was offered the gig.
That's amazing. So you worked for Tony Hawk.
I was working with him, or for his company for a while.
So getting back to this issue of religion, now you're out on the West Coast, you're working with Tony Hawk. How did you end up going into this transition of becoming an atheist? You come out of this Christian school scenario. You talk about being conflicted. Did that stay with you?
Yeah, to bring it back home. Yeah, like I was sort of conflicted. I remember I had a friend back here, actually before I went to the West Coast. I had a friend, like he pulled out something from my past that made me feel conflicted. It was probably my early mid-20s where like the new Danzig album came out.
That's clearly evil.
It was like Danzig 2. And he's like, oh, you gotta hear this. You gotta hear it. It's so good. I was like, oh yeah, I remember he pulled out the CD, he opened it, and it then folded into it, the cover thing, and folded into an upside down cross.
Oh, can't have that.
So I was like, oh wow, oh God, these songs are really good. Like it's really edgy. Oh God, it's got a really good rhythm to it. Wow, this is good. Like, the songs had a texture to it. Yeah, it was a really good album. It's really good. And I remember feeling somewhere to like, should I like this stuff?
You shouldn't like it.
There I was probably only, I just had a little bit of Christianity just kind of sprinkled in there. Yeah, and it was definitely like some of the lyrics. Well, this is some pretty evil stuff.
Pretty dumb.
It was well into the realm of Satanism. Yeah, I'm like, but I liked it. I couldn't deny it. Like,
couldn't deny it was like, good music.
I've always had these questions, like how to reconcile this stuff I learned in junior high and high school, and how to reconcile stuff in my head.
Yeah, this binary thinking kind of thing.
Yeah, I remember a radio doctor that was a talk radio doctor that I was a big fan of. But I mentioned this book. You have to get this book, the newest Carl Sagan book. And it's called Demon Haunted World. It's such a valuable book. Like, you just talked up this book. It's interesting. I'm going to have to pick up that book. And I've been reading a lot of books about philosophy, and I got inspired. There's a bookstore across the street from my work, and I went and bought a copy. And that night, I opened up that book, and I became enthralled in it. It was life-changing.
Right, so this book's rocking your world.
Huh? I couldn't stop reading it. The first part of the book is basically explaining the world of wonder that's in science, that never mind things are supernatural or speculative. The things that are really going on in science, and medicine, astrophysics, astronomy, or whatever, is way more amazing than what people are speculating with UFOs or Bigfoot or whatever. Supernatural speculation type stuff. Pay attention to this. And then the book goes further into belief in the supernatural is actually harming the world. It's actually doing something wrong. It's really, hence the title, Demon Haunted World, that these demons from supernatural, you know, are actually harming the world. They're haunting the world. The earth could be such much a better place if we trusted science and reason and logic more than, you know, woo. Superstition.
Is it specifically religion that he's talking about, or supernatural belief systems?
It moves on to that, believing in supernatural, a false narrative, and then it moves on to how much harm religion has done to the world, how much science is perpetuated. There was a line in that book from Carl Sagan, and that's what really grabbed me. His quote is, "Advances in medicine and agriculture have saved vastly more lives than have been lost in all wars in history." I read that line and I went, mind blown. Science has saved more lives than what we've lost in the slaughter of people in war.
Oh, yeah.
Over human history. When I read that quote, it completely blew my mind. And I, you know, that was a pivotal moment in kind of my thought and logic. And then I went on to read the book more, and the book pushes the argument even further. The argument of the book is basically believing in false narratives and superstition and religion is actually immoral. That the higher ground is science. The belief in science and skepticism and being skeptic is more moral than believing in supernatural or religion. He pushes that argument a bit further than I had ever heard before. To me, that was like, snap, wow.
So that was your deconstruction right there.
That pushed me over the edge. And at that moment, you know, when I got through that after it said that, the argument that it's immoral to believe in anything supernatural, wow. Like, that just completely pushed me over the edge. Like you said, deconstruction, completely deconstructed and reassembled how I thought.
And that book back together.
Changed my... The first book, I got to the end of it. I immediately went back to the beginning.
You read it again.
And I made notes. My wife now, my girlfriend, Matt, that was the first gift I bought her was that book. And she read it. And it blew her mind. That was just a really pivotal moment for me where the chains of supernatural, like religion or Christianity, kind of just fell away. And I went, okay, I'm an atheist, you know, it's like coming out. Like, I'm an atheist.
That's it.
I don't believe in this stuff.
Well, you have to go back and question this whole thing of what is the purpose of religion anyway. I was reading an article today. It was quite interesting. They did a study back in 2014 and they asked people, what do you think religion is supposed to be for? And most people think that religion is about, you know, helping us to understand the difference between right and wrong, good and evil, sacred and secular, as you say, some of these dichotomy kind of things. And it's when it gets into this issue of then enforcing this purity code, and that's what religion is supposed to be about, then you can get into a lot of real problems, because when people do something wrong, in air quotes, that their religion says is wrong or immoral, they feel that sense of guilt and shame and, you know, everything else, where those are the things you described. Yeah. You felt guilty. You felt conflicted because you were told these behaviors, these actions were wrong or immoral or against God's code or whatever. And is that in fact what religion is supposed to be about anyway? This is the whole question. And like you said, you can see then how it could be seen as an immoral thing because it's laying all these burdens on people, the guilt and the shame. And then conversely, when someone does something good, they feel a sense of pride because they've done all the right things. Mm-hmm. So it's a double-edged sword there in a way. You feel bad when you do something that's wrong, but you feel really good when you do something that's right. So it's kind of a lose-win scenario.
Yeah, and there's aspects of morality that doesn't really belong to religion, or Christianity in specific.
Why would you say morality doesn't belong to religion?
To go back to fundamentals, we probably paleo times or whatever, we learned that murdering your neighbor was not a good idea. You know, we learned that early, not to cause anybody else harm, because it's just the wrong thing to do and you don't feel good about doing it. Yeah. That's morality. I think there's fear and morality. And I think those are totally separate things. Like, you did not wish to do harm to your neighbor because you just don't want to do harm to your neighbor. You don't want to break into your neighbor's house and steal their stuff because you don't want to hurt them. If the only thing holding you back from that is repercussions, whether it's legal or spiritual or you're going to hell, that's the only thing holding you back. You don't have morality. You have fear.
Yeah, it's just fear of the law or whatever. Different. Not necessarily doing it because it's the right thing to do. So now, where are you at now? I mean, you say, okay, you realize you were an atheist when you read this book by Carl Sagan. How are you working that out now? Where would you say you're at now?
No, that's a good question. I think kind of where that came out, like, I am an atheist. Something I learned quickly, I think coming out, well, first off, I don't really like the word atheist now, looking back. I don't think that's a very good title. I don't like being defined by something you don't believe in. Being defined by something you don't like or what you don't believe in, I think is a little silly. But I prefer to think of even I use the word atheist because it's lack of a better term. I prefer to think of myself as a skeptic humanist.
Right, so you're a skeptic humanist.
Atheist is a title. Like, I have to throw out that word. If somebody confronts me and says, are you an atheist? I go, yeah, I am. But if I did define myself, it's more a skeptic humanist. Yeah, I'd learned about Carl Sagan before, and I read a little bit of Broken Brain, but this was his novel that really was groundbreaking for me. After that, I discovered other people. I discovered, you know, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens. I knew about, a big fan of Penn and Teller, Penn and Jillette. I was a fan of them before, but I didn't understand their underpinning, you know, their shtick yeah. or whatever. But I've learned about it now. Also, James Randi. He's a great skeptic.
Yes, the Amazing Randi.
Big fan of the Amazing Randi. Big fan of him for a couple reasons. The Amazing Randi, he's not a scientist. He's a magician. He has no college training. Neither do Penn and Teller. But I became fans of these people. They became rock stars to me. And I had an insatiable penchant for all their media, their books, their videos. And yeah, they became heroes, rock stars. Yeah, I think Hitchens has since passed away, but he became, I think, my favorite. Those people became my rock stars, my heroes.
Probably wrap it up now. What kind of advice?
Oh, okay.
What kind of advice would you give to someone who is coming out of the same situation that you were in? That's something I always like to ask people. What advice would you give? Let's say you're talking to this person who's feeling those conflicted
sort of right
and wrong things.
Okay, yeah. I think it's two things. What I discovered very quickly was that coming out sort of an atheist is very similar what I know now to me coming out gay, that you're just a non-believer. There's pushback. You'll meet people. If it comes up in conversation, they're shocked. They're outraged. There's definitely a pushback or outrage. And the other thing is, I think losing your faith is very similar to a divorce, because I think, you know, having faith in your partner or whatever, and that falls apart, you lose trust in that. I think it's very, very similar. You can look back at this past time and go, oh, that was a colossal waste of time. And I think you do go through a phase where losing your faith or getting divorced, I think it's a similar thing in a sense that you do have a certain amount of time where you look back, like I said, it was a colossal waste of time and energy. And what the hell was I thinking? And I think you go through that period where I think I was with religion, or you're very cynical. You look back and you kind of want to make fun of the people. You reach a point where you look back and you go, huh, well, I learned something. Like, it wasn't all bad. I learned something there. I have fond memories. I had a great takeaway from it. Like Christianity, there's an atheist Joe. Basically, you want to hide something from a Christian? put in a Bible. They never look there. And it's kind of a cynical joke. It's a little mean-spirited joke. But actually, I found that that was sort of true. And that's what made me kind of come to terms with what I learned about Christianity before, and that it wasn't a waste of time, is that somebody did confront me about my beliefs or lack of belief. They questioned me, found I had the chop. I have biblical ammunition. So, I really knew what I was talking about.
So ironically, you know, your background kind of fed into that.
Yeah. I've had some people that put themselves out there as devout Christians. I mentioned something to a good friend I knew through surfing. I said, voluntary sacrifice of your own child is a reoccurring theme in the Bible. He became very angry. He said, how dare you? It's not true. And I go, you must have read a whole different Bible. You must have read the dumbed down children's version. You know, and I could come up with specific examples, and he was shocked. And I think it did make him go back and think. I look back at my teaching in Christianity. That was my takeaway from it. It gave me chops, some understanding of this literature. And, you know, that's a gift in a lot of ways. You don't have to be angry.
So you've kind of come full circle in a way. Not becoming a Christian again, but you kind of, the angry atheist phase is kind of gone by the wayside.
Yeah.
You're starting to see maybe there's a bigger picture here.
Yeah. And I've come to the conclusion that there's a lot of things with, like, you know, the atheist side as well. Like, to kind of boil it down, as atheists or non-believers, it doesn't behoove you to call Christians stupid or unenlightened or gullible. It doesn't. Because it's not true at all. On the other hand, it doesn't make sense for Christians to call atheists angry, bitter people with broken moral compass. Ridicule doesn't help.
Yeah, it's not going to get you anywhere, is it? You certainly can't have a respectful dialogue, can you?
Yeah.
If you're just pointing fingers and calling names of the other person.
It's easy to, like I said, to look at somebody that is ingrained in a certain belief and to look down at it, look down your nose at it. For a couple of reasons, I don't think that's right. My theory is that believing in false narratives, folklore, or religion, it's hard to give up. I think it's imprinted in our DNA. Thousands of years ago, our child looked up at their parents and said, what happens when we die? And the father doesn't want to, or mother doesn't want to have no answer. They got those answers from religion, folklore, whatever. And I think it's gone on so long, I think it's imprinted in our DNA. There's something about us that wants to believe in a false narrative. It's our way of trying to control the world, control what we don't know. And I'm not saying atheists are more enlightened or whatever. All sane people have a little bit of atheism in them, or doubt.
Yeah, there's a seed of doubt in
them. But I think that's why it's very hard for a lot of people to give up there. It's very hard to change your behavior. It's very hard to change your beliefs, especially if your parents and your schools have kind of drilled this into you.
Well, we were raised in it, you know, that's the whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
We were raised in it.
Yeah.
I more than you, and it's very emotionally threatening. It's your whole worldview. It's everything you know, and you're questioning these things. Yeah, it's very disturbing and very threatening, and you see why, I can see why most people just don't want to do it, because it rocks their whole world, and everything they know about themselves, or they think they know, is blown apart.
Bad enough for, like, some of us Christians. Think how bad it is for Orthodox Jews.
Yeah, you're not going to walk away from it.
Or families. That's a whole other thing. And the other thing I just want to touch on briefly, you know, it's about false narratives. There's a reason very smart people can believe in seemingly nonsensical things. I have a very smart friend. He's a great father. He runs his own home business. He's a great guy. He believes in aliens. So my point is, it's not good for, like, non-believers, atheists, or whatever, to look at people that are religious and look at them as stupid. There's a lot of really smart people, very smart, productive people, good people, that believe in very nonsensical things. I have to catch myself and stop, you know, where I see that ladder. It's easier to walk underneath it. you stop yourself for a second.
But it's bad luck.
Yeah. So my point is, dealing with family, friends, people around you, I think it's important for non-believers to understand, like, there's some science around the neurology of convincing or arguing. Basically, it's a twofold thing for me. I think when you have your good friends, people around you, your family or whatever, I think it's actually insulting where they come up with a crazy, what you think is a crazy idea, or you think they're wrong. you know they're wrong. You strongly feel they're wrong. I think the most insulting thing to them is to smile and nod, and then you turn away and you roll your eyes at it. Your friend, your family member is stupid, and they can't be convinced. I think the most endearing thing to your best friend, your family member, is going, I think you're wrong, and this is why. And you present all the reasons why. I think that's a loving thing to do. Assume that they're smart enough to come to your side to understand. On the flip side of that, when you look into the science of that, the neurological science of arguing somebody and confronting them, stacking evidence against them, it doesn't work. You can take somebody who believes in whatever, whether it's aliens or vaccines cause autism, and take them through a whole journey of here's why you're wrong and here's why. Present them with incredible evidence. What happens is they double down. You're actually ingraining them harder into their belief. Their false narrative.
They're just going to dig in more and resist all the more, aren't they?
They dig in more. But there's like a technique how you should approach friends and family. And it's about allowing them to question their beliefs rather than just beating them down with facts. You're better off saying, where was the first time you learned about that narrative? Whatever it is, aliens or religion or anything. And, you know, they might say, you know, I saw it on Oprah. Your response is, do you think that's a good source of information? And they go, yeah, maybe. You know, in their brain, they're thinking, no, maybe not. Even though they don't say that.
Yeah, they might question.
Another thing interesting, like you can say, well, how invested are you in that idea? How invested are you on a scale of 1 to 10? And what's very interesting with people is they won't say 10. They'll say like 7, 8. And you're allowing them to admit to themselves that there's 30% they don't believe in that. That's a better way to approach talking to people about false narratives.
What a fascinating story. Tim Malin, Surfing with the Atheist. What did you think? What really strikes me about the whole story, the whole journey really, is that it offers up a brand new perspective for people who don't understand what it's like to be in the church or to be in this Christian environment, this Christian bubble. Here's a guy who was dropped in from the outside world, almost like an alien coming in to observe a foreign planet, but becoming part of the system. And we heard how it affected his mind, especially in this realm of science. And you have to wonder, why are Christians so threatened? Well, of course, this is nothing new, is it? This has been going on ever since modern science became modern science. And from the Christian point of view, and you can see this going back as far as the 18th century, they believe that science contradicts or at least challenges what they believe the Bible teaches. People like Ken Ham, for example, read Genesis as if it were a scientific textbook explaining all the elements of creation as they understand it. And of course, even today, many Christians believe that Darwinian evolution is the enemy. So many Christians view evolution as nothing more than an atheistic justification of a way to live in a world without God. Now, I mentioned I was going to be reading a quote from Carl Sagan's book, The Demon-Haunted World. And he goes into this issue of contrasting science versus organized religions. Whereas on the one hand, science has built-in factors to determine errors and determine mistakes, he says religion doesn't, if you really look at it. And he says, quote, "This is one of the reasons that the organized religions do not inspire me with confidence. Which leaders of the major faiths acknowledge that their beliefs might be incomplete or erroneous and establish institutes to uncover possible doctrinal deficiencies beyond the tests of everyday living? Who is systematically testing the circumstances in which traditional religious teachings may no longer apply? It is certainly conceivable," he says, "that doctrines and ethics that may have worked fairly well in patriarchal or patristic or medieval times might be thoroughly invalid in the very different world we inhabit today. What sermons even-handedly examine the God hypothesis? What rewards are religious skeptics given by the established religions, or for that matter, social and economic skeptics by the society in which they swim?" And he concludes his thought by saying, "Despite all the talk of humility," he says, "show me something comparable in religion. Scripture is said to be divinely inspired, a phrase with many meanings, but what if it's simply made up by fallible humans?" Now, why would Carl Sagan even pose such a question? He concludes by saying, quote, the fact that so little of the findings of modern science is prefigured in Scripture, to my mind, cast further doubt on its divine inspiration, end quote. So in other words, what I think Carl Sagan is saying here is that if the God who created the universe, according to the Genesis account as read by people like Ken Ham and others, and if this same God set up the laws of science, as it were, then there should be more in the Bible, if it indeed is divinely inspired, that prefigures modern science, as he says. So you have to question these things, and I think this is a good way to start your own deconstruction, to start your journey, if you haven't already, questioning things like this, looking at issues like how does a person reconcile their Christian faith and their beliefs in the Bible with the findings of modern science. So these are some good questions to pose. I hope that you found this discussion with Tim helpful. I want to hear from you. If you have any comments, questions, or feedback, as I said before, there's a variety of ways that you can get a hold of me, and I can also put you in touch with Tim if you want to talk with him a bit further. Those links are in the show notes. I'll just say real quickly at the end, come back next Friday to hear part one of my conversation with Dana Stinson. This is an absolutely unbelievable story of a trans woman who grew up in the church. Her parents were pastors, and she is going to tell an absolutely amazing story of her journey of dealing with gender identity and coming out as a trans woman in the midst of being involved in leadership at a church. So this is an unbelievable story. We're going to be bringing you part one of that next Friday, so make sure and don't forget, come back for that next week. All right, thank you once again for joining myself and Tim Malins. I hope you enjoyed this ride of Surfing with the Atheist. Come back next Friday for part one with Dana Stinson right here on Mindshift.